From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Paul and Silas, bound in jail, had no money for to go their bail.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on.
It's been called the moment when a gear in the machinery shifted, the single personal act that changed the tide of race relations in America. The 1955 December evening in Montgomery, Alabama, when Rosa Parks said no.
The driver noted that the front of the bus was filled with white passengers and there would be two or three men standing. He looked back and asked that the seat where I had taken, along with three other persons, one in the seat with me and two across the aisle, was seated. He demanded the seats that we were occupying. The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused to do so.
The woman who's been called the mother of the civil rights movement died last night at her home in Detroit. Rosa Parks was 92. She was rarely seen in public in recent years. The hero of a revolution was suffering progressive dementia. Her attorney said she died while taking an evening nap in the company of friends and family. Nearly 50 years on, it is remarkable to recall the power of the spirit of this one woman. This hour On Point, we're remembering Rosa Parks and looking at how the civil rights movement resonates today. We will hear in this hour from Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, from Michael Eric Dyson, historians Robert Pratt and David Brinkley, civil rights icon Dorothy Height, and former Civil Rights Commissioner Mary Berry. You can join the conversation as well. Do you remember when Rosa Parks said no? And if that was long before your time, what does that time in our history mean to you? Who carries the Rosa Parks spirit today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Athens, Georgia, is Robert Pratt, professor of African American history at the University of Georgia and author of We Shall Not Be Moved, The Desegregation of the University of Georgia and the Color of Their Skin, Education and Race in Richmond, Virginia, 1954 to 89. Robert Pratt, wonderful to have you back to the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
So at the age of 92, the great age, after a life of tremendous impact, Rosa Parks has passed. And I just wonder, before we dive on in, your first thoughts as you contemplate that today.
Well, it clearly is a time for sober reflection. Rosa Parks has been referred to for a long time now as the mother of the civil rights movement because of her act of defiant protest. And it was something really that sort of galvanized an entire generation of African-American people in this country. People had been mistreated. Black people in Montgomery had been mistreated on the bus system for many years. African-Americans in other cities had been mistreated for many years. And so as an African-American woman in Montgomery, Alabama, who had a career of civil rights activism. She had been a part of the NAACP, had served as its secretary. Mm-hmm. She was a soft-spoken woman personally, but she was held in tremendous esteem, very highly regarded in Montgomery among black and white citizens alike. And on this particular day, she had decided that she had had enough. And I think perhaps in one moment, the years of second-class treatment, daily indignities being heaped upon her and others of her race, it was a point that for her, she said enough. And so she didn't get up. And as a result of that, a civil rights movement was born.
Professor Pratt, I wish you'd take us back to that time. It can seem almost impossible to imagine, though we know very well, full well, that it was there, but an America in which a black woman would be required to stand and let a white man sit down, and everything that suggests must have been going on in the world around it, in that world of where Jim Crow laws still stood. Can you paint a picture for us of African-American life at that time, particularly, I guess, in the South and the constraints around it?
Well, you know, teaching African-American history or U.S. history to my students today, I have the same challenge because when I try to explain to them what the social fabric of American society was like at that time, it really is hard for them to fathom. It is inconceivable to them that a woman would be forced to give up her seat and let a man have it. But this was the reality, the harsh reality of Jim Crow, which, of course, began to take shape in the American South not long after the end of the Civil War. Gradually, by the end of the 19th century, it would be codified as law, all kinds of laws. And, of course, Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1896 decision in which the Supreme Court had held that facilities for whites and blacks could be separate as long as they were equal. So Plessy had become the law of the land, and segregation was deeply entrenched and ingrained in virtually every aspect of American society, from the cradle to the grave. And Montgomery, Alabama, was no different from many other southern cities at this time, where everything was segregated, movie theaters, restaurants, parks, beaches, you know, hotels, motels, libraries, you name it. And so seating on public transportation was segregated, as was in many, many southern cities. But the system in Montgomery, Alabama, was especially insulting to African-American passengers, because law at the time required that blacks sit at the rear of the bus. Mm-hmm. Whites were seated at the front. The white passengers would get on the front of the bus, pay their fare, and then take their seats. The African-American passengers would get on the front of the bus only long enough to pay the fare. Mm-hmm. They would then have to exit the bus and go around the side and enter the bus from the side.
To even enter the back door, not even come through?
Yes, yes. Wow. For the fear that they might accidentally brush up against some white person making physical contact. Mm. And that, of course, was especially insulting to black people. And, of course, during these occasions when they would exit the bus to reboard at the side, some of the white drivers were known to pull off.
Sure.
And leave them standing there.
They're fair paid, but no ride.
They're fair paid, but no ride. And so you had whites sitting in the front, you had blacks in the rear, and then there were a couple of seats that were always left vacant, the so-called buffer zone, mm-hmm. Further dividing the races to make sure that the point was not missed. And if the bus got full, then those seats would be taken. But, of course, when there were no seats left, if whites came on the bus later, mm-hmm. Then the black passengers were expected to stand. And if they did not heed social custom by voluntarily relinquishing their seats, then they were ordered by the white bus driver to get up and give the seats to white passengers.
I want to ask you about that, but let's listen, if we could, for just a moment, Professor Pratt, to the voice of Rosa Parks once more here. Hear from an interview in December 1955, the year she took her stand in her seat, about why she refused to go to the back of the bus.
The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose. I had decided that I would have to know once and for all what rights I had as a human being and a citizen, even in Montgomery, Alabama.
We know what happened afterward. The 13-month boycott of the Montgomery bus system led by the young minister, Martin Luther King, Jr., the segregation ordinance declared unconstitutional, Federal Interstate Commerce Commission banning segregation on interstate trains and buses, but then, of course, many years of civil rights struggle that came after that. Robert Pratt, on that evening, December 1st, 1955, when Rosa Parks did this, how brave an act was that? Was the society, was it pastime? Was everyone waiting, assuming someone would soon do this? Or was it really still in the teeth of a strong presumption that African Americans would obey the rules?
Well, let's remember that Rosa Parks was not the first African-American person to defy Montgomery's segregated ordinance on buses. Mm-hmm. There had been others who had come before her, and the NAACP had been hoping for some time that they could make a case out of it. But for various reasons, some of the earlier people who had defied the segregation ordinance, did not make good plaintiffs. And so the thing that was so unique in Rosa Parks' case was that here was a woman who was so very well respected in all of Montgomery circles, black and white, long career of work with the NAACP, and it was because of the high esteem in which she was held that she was approached after she was arrested on that particular evening. E.D. Nixon, who was the president of the local NAACP in Montgomery. He had also been the one of the leaders in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and Maids. And E.D. Nixon was considered by many to be one of the most important black leaders in the city of Montgomery. It was Nixon who approached Mrs. Parks, and he said, with your case, I think we can break down segregation in the city of Montgomery if you'd be willing to go through with it. She said she had to consult with her husband and her mother at the time before making the decision that she would indeed go ahead with it. And so I think that when we stop to reflect on the enormous challenges facing black Montgomerans at that time, the courage of Rosa Parks, we certainly need to remember people like E.D. Nixon, who were so important in organizing this protest.
The community around her.
Yes, Joanne Gibson Robinson, who was a black faculty member at Alabama State College, part of the Women's Political Council. So it was clearly, beginning with Rosa Parks' act of courage, it would become a grassroots protest.
Robert Pratt, please stand by. We're remembering Rosa Parks. She died yesterday at 92. You can join the conversation. Do you remember when she sat down and would not be moved? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Wake up, yes,
glory. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are remembering Rosa Parks in this hour, dead last night at age 92, and we're looking at how the civil rights movement resonates today, 50 years after one black woman would not give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. You can join our conversation in this hour. Can you believe that 50 years ago in America, black Americans were required to stand up and give up their seats on a bus to whites? Were you there? Was that your time? What did Rosa Parks mean to you? Or were you not even born for decades after Rosa Parks and the Civil Rights Revolution? What does she mean? What does that movement mean to a new generation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined in this hour from Athens, Georgia, by Robert Pratt, professor of history at the University of Georgia, author of We Shall Not Be Moved. We're joined right now from Philadelphia by Michael Eric Dyson, professor of humanities at University of Pennsylvania. He's author of I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr. Michael Eric Dyson, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And your thoughts, your sentiments first on the passing of Rosa Parks.
Well, she was an ordinary woman who did an extraordinary thing, and therefore the monumental character of her, I think, contribution cannot be gainsaid or overlooked. This was a woman who, out of the depth of her commitment to social justice, performed an act that day, a gesture of extraordinary meaning to those who would seize on it and use it as a basis to launch the modern civil rights movement. And as Professor Pratt has been speaking of, there was an ocean, a veritable ocean of black female protest against the vicious forms of white supremacy and social injustice that had prevailed. Joanne Robinson and other women who were part of the Women's Political Committee there in Montgomery, generated and organized an enormous attention to Ms. Parks' gesture, and therefore facilitated the civil rights movement in a fashion that they have unfortunately not been given credit for. Rosa Parks stands as a shining monument to their activity and to the will of ordinary people to make a change in the world in which we live.
And Michael Eric Dyson, what about that determinant of Rosa Parks today? It's been years since she was really in public and speaking. We don't know what she thinks about the way American society evolved in the decades after her big gesture on that day. But how do you see the resonance of it today? Is it still ringing? Do people still hear it? What does she stand for, and is it still a kind of dynamic symbol?
Well, no doubt. I think that even those people who are unconscious of who she is or who she was and what she represented have benefited from her contribution nonetheless. So in one sense, the trajectory of any individual's or society's consciousness toward, you know, a sense of awareness, that is to say, who shaped who I am, what contributions made it possible for me to do what I do. And in that trajectory, in that pilgrimage toward self-consciousness, you're going to have to meet Rosa Parks. Whether you're white or black or Latino or Native American or Asian American, she was, after all, a woman who, by refusing to stand up, who sat down and refused to get up, really lifted an entire generation, an entire nation on her shoulders, symbolically speaking. And that continues to resonate. Now, what's interesting is that we do find some of her words, of course, in the books that have been written about her, and in her autobiographical narrative. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that I think that Mrs. Parks was seized upon as a dynamic symbol of racial consciousness, but it was quite controversial. You'll, after all, remember that the hip-hop group Outkast had a song called Rosa Parks.
Which she sued them over and kept after them. She did not want, or at least her family, I'm not sure, did not want her name used by Outkast as the title of that song, and went after them in the courts for a long time.
Yeah, I think that was one of the unfortunate consequences of the people around Mrs. Parks, even though I'm sure they were well-intentioned, thinking because it was a hip-hop song, it would do great dishonor to Miss Parks. Mm-hmm. But the song said, I met a gypsy and she hit me to some life game to stimulate and activate the left and right brain. So Rosa Parks was a symbolic figure in that song. You know, hush that fuss, everybody move to the back of the bus. Mm-hmm. Do you want to bump or slump with us? We're the type of people who make the party get crunk. All they were saying is that the whack rappers now have to get to the back of the bus, that Rosa Parks has taught us that you don't want to be mediocre, and that they seized upon her symbolic worth as a means to extend her significance into the hip-hop generation. So when you're a dynamic symbol of change, sometimes you might be used in ways that you find problematic, offensive, or contrary to your ideals. I don't think in that case that Outkast was using her in any way that was untoward or in any sense that would have subverted her fundamental commitment to racial or social justice. But when you're dynamic, it happens in that way.
A kind of stand-up message, or in this case, sit down and stay right there. Michael Eric Dyson, Robert Pratt, please stand by. We're going to hear a lot of voices in this hour, and I want to be sure that our callers are part of this conversation, this remembrance, too. I want to begin to turn to them. Michelle is calling from Nashville. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I think what Rosa Parks did was extremely beneficial. It was an honorary thing to do. And it's just sad to see so many years later, because I'm 28, so I was not born when that happened. Mm-hmm. But to see that there's still prejudice dominant in the United States, I mean, you could be out here. I work hard for my family and I try to own my own business, and there is so much prejudice out here that, you know, if you don't try to fight back, you will be lost in a crowd. And then on the flip side of that, there are some black people that just run around and, you know, still want to feel victimized and do nothing. But I think as a nation, we need to get past this prejudice that's out here, because people like Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, what they did, they believed in. We still are not seeing the dream that Martin Luther King had.
Michelle, let me ask you, when you see that prejudice today, describe it for us. What form does it come in? Would Rosa Parks recognize it?
It comes in form now of money. I know everybody's heard that the gap is widening between the have and have-nots. A lot of intellectual people have been on your show that have talked about that. Mm-hmm. And that is the weapon that's used now, because we won't tolerate the segregation. Okay, so you just keep us from being able to do different things. Like, there's been employers on, like, NBC Dateline that came on there and said, you know, when we come across a black name, we just throw it in the trash, you know. And so I think that as a nation, we have to get past this thought of, oh, there's no prejudice, trying to mask it over and really deal with it so that, you know, we can be a prosperous nation, because there's so much prejudice out here, and I deal with it daily. and especially in the South, is way more than I experienced up north.
Michelle, we appreciate your call today, and we hear your sentiments. Thank you very much for being with us. Michael Eric Dyson, what do you say to that? Of a different kind, Michelle says, not so much segregation, but still there. A fair assessment?
Well, absolutely. I think that she's pointing to the huge chasm in class relations in American society. Katrina opened up that awareness for millions of Americans who didn't understand that poverty persisted, that racism continued to ruin lives. And not racism necessarily, as the caller was saying, in terms of a particular bigotry that exists, although there's plenty of that to go around, but there are structural and institutional factors of racism that manifest themselves. For instance, she talked about the huge gulf in wealth in this country, and certainly in terms of income, between black and white people. Even when you control for education, there is radical disparity that cannot be totally explained by the inherent characteristics of the people who are trying to get jobs and keep jobs. She mentioned, for instance, the study that was done by the University of Chicago economists that suggested that if you have a black-sounding name, an African-American-sounding name, Shaniqua, Taliqua, or Muhammad, that you're less likely to be invited for an interview for a job. So the reality is that there is the persistence of inequality in America, and that the subtle shadings and the nuances of racial inequality prevail in this country. And I think she's right. We've got to speak to those. And I think that the shifted terrain of racial struggle and the tug of war over how we treat people in this country indeed has been located on a class basis. And that's both between African-American people and the broader mainstream society, especially white Americans, but also within African-American culture. The vicious class wars that have been unleashed with the, I think, vicious comments of Mr. Bill Cosby last year, where he assaulted poor people for their names and their style of dress and for the music they listen to and the like. Well, the civil rights movement, unfortunately, has not touched, by and large, the lives of those who are persistently poor generation after generation. And so what we have to do then is to turn an internal light upon those darkened regions of racial compact within our communities to figure out how we can also combat some of the vicious forms of bigotry that prevail.
Michael Eric Dyson, I know we just have you for another minute more. I know you met Rosa Parks in the 90s. If you could send a message off to her, if you'd had the chance, what would your parting message to Rosa Parks be?
Thank you so much, mother of the civil rights movement, for birthing in the womb of your imagination a people who were determined to move beyond the despotic will of a white supremacist culture and to move beyond the no that was being hurled at us and to say yes. And by sitting down, you allowed us to stand up. And we love and appreciate what you did. I was fortunately able to express some of those sentiments to her when we shared the stage together in Chicago, when a portion of a street was named after Emmett Till. And there on that stage, Emmett Till's late mother, Mamie Till Mobley, and now the late, great Rosa Parks, two great warriors for our people, met together in concert to oppose racism even then, and I'm honored to have shared that stage with them and remember them with the greatest of affection and a renewed determination to commit my life like they did to making sure that justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
Michael Eric Dyson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're joined now from Houston, Texas, by Douglas Brinkley, author of the biography Rosa Parks. He's professor and director of the Theodore Roosevelt Center for American Civilization at Tulane University. Douglas Brinkley, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I wonder if you could do us a favor just for a moment and remind us of the white community's reaction to Rosa Parks' case in 1955 and the year and years that followed. How did the community around her and across the country take on this woman?
First off, Professor Dyson had just called at the beginning of his comments that she was an ordinary woman. She was not. She was very extraordinary in many ways. She was born in Tuskegee in 1913, and a month after she was born, Harriet Tubman died, and in many ways a baton was passed from the Underground Railroad movement to the freedom struggle through Rosa Parks.
And we've heard from Professor Robert Pratt, who's with us as well, that she was an activist in her community at that time.
Right.
This wasn't arbitrary.
Through the 30s and through the 40s, during World War II, she was going to sue the state of Alabama for her right to vote, which was denied twice. She led a group of students to the library herself to integrate Montgomery's Library for African American Kids. The point is, we focus so much on December 155, mm-hmm. but she was a secretary of the NAACP of Alabama, going around, for example, and collecting oral histories of black women raped by white men, which was a very bold and rare thing to be doing in 40s, 50s Alabama.
With that in mind, may I ask you, was she looking for this chance to refuse the bus rules? Was she?
Yes, she was.
Fishing for
it. I went and found her notes at Wayne State University in the summer of 1955. She was at the Highlander Folk School. This is a place where they were teaching Gandhian civil disobedience and new tactics because of Brown versus Topeka. Rosa Parks was very conscious of that need. In fact, in March of 55, a woman named Claudette Colvin, who now lives in Brooklyn, was going to be the first case. She refused to give up her bus seat in Montgomery, but it turned out she was unwed and pregnant, and the national NAACP didn't believe she would be the poster woman to enforce integration on the transportation system of Montgomery. Rosa Parks was the one counseling Claudette. She was helping her through all of her trials in March and April and May and June of 1955. Then she went to civil disobedience school in Tennessee, Rosa Parks. Then Emmett Till happened.
So she was
December
prepped.
1, when she woke up that morning, she did not say, "I'm going to do an act of civil disobedience today," but she was angry, and she had been angry since her childhood at the injustices. And also, talking when I interviewed Rosa Parks many times in many different locations, one time we talked about her ethnicity, and she didn't consider herself black. You know, she has a lot of Scotch-Irish in her. Mm-hmm. She has Creek Indian. If you look at her, you can see that. She's very proud of her Scotch-Irish and Native American heritage, as well as this African-American heritage. Her message ultimately was about universal peace and love. And in recent years, she had gone to Japan, was very interested in Buddhism, read the Bible every day also, and continued up until her death to be a deaconess at the AME Church St. Matthew in Detroit.
But at that time, describe for us how she inspired black Americans, how she shamed or inspired white Americans.
She was trying to not shame people. She was trying to speak to her heart. But one personal story comes into play, and that's that previously a segregationist, a mean, foul-mouthed bus driver in Montgomery named James Blake, who just recently died. Mr. Blake, in the 1930s, when Rosa Parks got on the bus, he started cursing at her, using the N-word, made her get on the back of the bus, walking outside in the rain, and he was so mean and crude to her, she just marched off the bus. So from virtually something like 17 years, she refused to get on a bus if Blake was the driver.
Wow.
And on December 155, she left Montgomery Fair Department Store after a long day of pressing clothes in the basement there, and she got absentmindedly on the wrong bus. She sat there, and when it turned around, it was Blake who had told her to move when an African American, when a white gentleman was there. And a misnomer is that there was a line in buses that said back of the bus. Well, it was a movable line that it was up to the bus driver's discretion. Many of the Montgomery bus drivers would not force blacks to the back of the bus,
but this one
Blake
did.
Was notorious for doing it.
Robert Pratt, you can feel in this description how Rosa Parks' determination, anger, mounted over a long, long time before that day.
Oh, it's evident. It was the effect of years of accumulated indignities and injustices that black people had to endure, not just in Montgomery, Alabama, but in this country, in the South in particular. And which is what makes, you know, her act of incredible heroism so significant that on this particular day she said enough. And I think we see in her and her actions and the actions of those that came after the power of collective protest. And I think that she is important particularly because she inspired black people to think of themselves and the power, the ability to create social change in this country.
And she was schooled and she was ready. Robert Pratt, Douglas Brinkley, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're 1-800-423-8255. Remembering Rosa Parks, this is On Point. I had a mighty hard time.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are remembering Rosa Parks in this hour. She died last night in Detroit, taking an evening nap at age 92. And we're looking at how the civil rights movement resonates today, 50 years after one black woman would not give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery. In June of 1999, Rosa Parks was awarded the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest civilian honor awarded by Congress. Here's President Clinton on that day.
Rosa Parks said, "I didn't get on that bus to get arrested. I got on that bus to go home." In so many ways, Rosa Parks brought America home.
Bill Clinton, honoring an American hero, Professor Robert Pratt joins us from Athens, Georgia in this hour, and Professor Douglas Brinkley, author of the biography Rosa Parks. Fred's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Fred, you're on the air. Hello, Fred, my friend. Are you there? Let's take another call. Carolyn is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, very well.
I would like to self-identify as a white woman who was active in the civil rights movement in Atlanta, Georgia in the 1960s and was so inspired by Rosa Parks that I named my first daughter, our first daughter, after her.
Wow.
She's Josina Parks.
How old is your daughter now?
She's 29 years old now.
And she carries the name?
Yes, she does.
And what moved you that far, Carolyn?
Well, as an activist in the civil rights movement, I care very much about civil rights and human relations in this country. I think that the future of America is the future of blacks and whites and all people together. And I was trying to inspire the next generation, I suppose, by giving her this name. I think I put a heavy weight on her shoulders, but to this day I'm still active with the NAACP and on the executive board in the Providence branch of the NAACP. So I still carry the dream, and I'm trying to transfer it to the next generation.
And how has the world responded to your white daughter named Rosa Parks? What reaction does she get?
Well, I think many people think that she's African-American to begin with. And it seems to be an odd idea, or mostly I'm sorry to say that it's greeted with pleasure by African-Americans and a sort of curiosity by white Americans. So I don't think we've achieved the dream that, she is a heroine to the entire country. I'm sorry to say that. I wish the country were much different from what I remember 30 years ago, but it has changed very little, to be quite honest.
But your gesture is a deep one and passed right on to your daughter there. And, Carolyn, we thank you very much for your call. We're joined right now from Washington by Mary Frances Berry. She was, from 1980 to 2004, a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, from 1993 to 2004, chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Mary Frances Berry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed. Sad day. Ms. Parks, she was a wonderful person and leader, and my only regret is that for so many years she was not given the kind of praise that she deserved as a heroine. It's only been in the last 25 years that since John Conyers, Congressman John Conyers,
mm-hmm. For whom she worked for many years,
mm-hmm. right, that she started to get the recognition that she deserved for what she did, which was key to the whole civil rights movement.
We've heard in this hour from historian Douglas Brinkley about her anger and determination when she was a younger woman, not so young, 42 in 1955, but to address the injustices that she saw. How would you describe her character, her temperament in her later years, Mary Frances Berry?
In her later years, she was resigned, happy, content. She felt that all this change that had taken place, which she really hadn't, projected, that so much change would happen, was important, and she was pleased that people recognized the contributions of all of these people who had made this change. But she understood, too, from all of her work for the congressman and others and getting around, that there were a lot of more things that needed to be done. So I think that she understood her celebrity and what people thought about her and how esteemed she was in the last years.
Mary Frances Berry, we're grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you so much
for
joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me take another call here. Cecilia is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Cecilia, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on, Sylvia.
Hi, sorry. Hi, I'm calling because I want to tell a story from my students. I do some workshops with an after school program in East Boston.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and what do you see there?
Oh, sorry, I just couldn't hear. So yesterday I asked them to draw a picture. Half of them drew a picture of a school that has a lot of resources, and they draw a beautiful school with lots of trees and flowers. And then the other half was to draw a picture of a school with no resources, you know, and they almost drew, you know, when it was finished, they said, oh, I guess it looks like a jail. And these are 7th and 8th graders. And then I asked them, okay, who goes to what school, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the nice school, they said, oh, well, I guess mostly rich white kids. And then the other school, they said, well, we go there, you know, kids who are not white. So, I mean, my point in telling the story is that even young kids today are very, very aware of this sort of underground segregation that is happening in Boston right here. That, you know, it's not enforced by a law, but it's enforced by economics and by a lot of other factors. And the worst thing about it is that these young students think that, oh, you know, well, this school is bad because our communities are bad, because we're lazy, or because we're dirty, and so they have internalized a lot of the things. And, you know, I think that that's the unfinished part of the civil rights revolution. That's where we need to work on now.
It loops back around and hits them that way. 7 years old and seeing that's from the mouths of babes, Cecilia. We appreciate your call very much. Thank you for that. Douglas Brinkley, in your later conversations with Rosa Parks, as she looked at the progress of the civil rights movement, progress that happened and progress that didn't happen, what was her assessment later in her life?
Well, you know, she, after the success of the Montgomery bus boycott, she left permanently Montgomery and moved to Detroit. And that's because her brother, Sylvester, was there. And he was her baby brother, who was a World War II veteran, was actually in Normandy and the Pacific Theater, and came back to Alabama and was spat on, denied unemployment, and was considered uppity because he wore a military uniform. This hazing that her brother got tormented her a great deal, and also she continued to get bomb threats and death threats while living in Montgomery. So she moved to Detroit in 57, and from 57 mm-hmm. to 65, she humbly, even though she was an internationally known person, she worked in Stockton Towel Company, a very, working blue-collar, she made dish rags and mm-hmm. towels for mm-hmm. a living mm-hmm. until John Conyers gave her a job. But during those periods, she stayed very active in the movement. She was at all the key moments. She was at the March on Washington and spoke. She was marched from Selma to Montgomery. She had no money, and people would find a little bit of cash just to get her someplace to go. But by the time her great two great loves of her life, Raymond, she never had children, Mrs. Mm-hmm. Park, she mm-hmm. couldn't. But her husband, who loved and stood by her, in fact, he had a couple nervous breakdowns during the boycott. It was so tense. Mm-hmm. But when he died and Martin Luther King was assassinated, those two losses made her a little less of the firebrand, a little less of the grassroots activist, and started really relying on scripture, on prayer, and became a much more serene person in the later years of her life. She didn't like confrontation as much as she liked healing gestures. And so she was one of the great projects she did at the end of her life in Detroit that I witnessed. I went up to a school she was working with that she would teach young people how to email and use email to senior citizens' homes.
Mm-hmm.
Seniors were computer phobic. It was all new to them. And so it formed this great bond between kids, say, in middle schools with seniors, and they created email relationships. So she was, and then she also ran programs taking students to study the history of the Underground Railroad. Her apartment in Detroit, her condo, overlooked the Detroit River into Canada, mm-hmm. which was the freedom ground for the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And just a block from where she lived in Detroit was where Frederick Douglass met with John Brown. And I think she thought of herself first and foremost as a Detroiter because that's where she loved it. That's where her community was. And she has, I believe, it's 13, 14 nieces and nephews. Her only brother, Sylvester, had a lot of kids, and so she was Aunt Rosie to a very large community there in Detroit.
Robert Pratt, let me put a similar question to you. For Rosa Parks and those of her early civil rights movement cohort, their sense in later decades of what they did and did not accomplish with all their effort and sacrifice?
Well, I think Rosa Parks clearly understood what she meant to the movement, and certainly when I had the opportunity to meet her in Atlanta at Ebenezer Baptist Church back in the late 1980s, she appeared to me to be a woman who was very at ease with her celebrity. She was certainly assured of her place in history. And I think that she would have taken enormous pride in knowing that she had been successful to at least a great extent in making America ashamed of itself, in exposing the cruelties of a barbaric system, exposing the racial and economic injustice that would ultimately lead Martin Luther King to issue a scathing critique of capitalism before his assassination in 1968. She had come to understand, I think, very clearly that navigating the oftentimes racist terrain of American society is a difficult struggle and it's a major challenge. But she, like so many of her contemporaries, rose to that challenge. People like Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer, just to mention a few of the women of the movement who gave so much, who really dedicated their lives to the cause. And so I think her passing, as sad as it is on this occasion, at the age of 92, we can sit back and we can reflect on her life. She had a full, rich life. But it also gives us an opportunity to reflect on the movement itself, the people who made a change, the people who really took a nation to a new level and forced this society to come to terms with itself. And there was, you know, I can't help but recall the comments made by one of the protesters during the Montgomery bus boycott. We think of the boycott as launching the civil rights movement, and it did in many ways. Mm-hmm. But let's not forget that there were African Americans who were pushing for change and agitating for social protest long before that. You had returning black World War II veterans who had fought in Europe fighting against Nazism and fascism, very proud of displaying their army uniforms, but to come home to a society where they were lynched in uniform and where they couldn't even be served a glass of water. But, you know, in Montgomery, you know, you had people like Rosa Parks who were willing to put it all on the line and to say, you know, this must end. We need to make America the country that it could be. And so, but that was this woman in the protests, and the boycott took a heavy toll on people. Professor Brinkley has already mentioned the nervous breakdowns
of
her husband. There were other people who lost jobs, whose livelihoods were threatened, whose lives were threatened, people who were daily, constantly harassed by Montgomery's white police officers. And it required an enormous sacrifice on the part of black people and their white allies in Montgomery. But there was this one woman who summed it up best, you know, when asked about what she had to endure and sustain in this movement. And I think her comments more or less summed it up for that generation. She said, "My feet is tired, but my soul is rested." And I think that really more or less reflected the sentiment of black Montgomery. And it would go on really to serve as the inspiration of the entire movement, that these were a part of the sacrifices that black people would have to make in order to finally be accorded the dignity that they deserved and first-class citizenship.
A city and ultimately a country buoyed by those sacrifices. Let's turn to Lansing,
yes.
Michigan, and Kathy's calling. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a music teacher, an elementary music teacher, and for me, Rosa Parks' legacy is that I need to help my students understand, because I work in a very low-income area, that you don't have to be held down by whatever your life circumstances are, that you can move forward and you can be empowered. I grew up in the 60s. I was actually born in 61 and grew up kind of colorblind because I lived in a very integrated community. And as I got older, I saw inequities that just made me sick. And so as an adult, you know, one of my goals working where I work is to expose students to lots of beautiful things they would never be exposed to otherwise, and to let them know, you know, you have access to anything you want, and I'm going to help you get there.
And you believe that they do? That's quite a compliment to Rosa Parks if they, in fact, have access to anything they want.
I think they do. I think they just they need somebody to tell them that. They need somebody to say, you don't have to, you know, deal with all of this past history of, you know, neglect, and I've got kids with all kinds of horrible problems, but I can say to them, you know, let's get you an education. Let's teach you what you need to know so that you can move forward and you can go to college and you can go as far as you possibly can.
If that's a
and
message,
I know there's still inequities, but at least if we can, you know, move kids forward, hopefully by the time I am elderly, there won't be as many.
Kathy, we appreciate your call. Douglas Brinkley, a message of determination certainly from Rosa Parks to reach for that thing you desire. Doug Brinkley, are you there, my friend? Sounds like we may have lost him. Our time is nearly at a close here. We've been remembering Rosa Parks, her life and her accomplishment, clearly touching a nerve with many people today. I want to thank Douglas Brinkley at Tulane University, now in Houston, as New Orleans struggles underwater there, for being with us in this hour. And Robert Pratt in Athens, Georgia, professor of African American history at the University of Georgia, we thank you very much for joining us.
It has been my pleasure.
We go out today with the words of Rosa Parks herself, speaking in a 1999 interview about why she believes that everyone has the right to be treated equally. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I think the American dream should to have a good life and to live well and to be a good citizen. I think it should apply to all of us. And that it is the land of the free and the home of the brave. And I believe it should be just that with all people who can think of themselves as human beings, and that they will enjoy the blessings of the freedom of this country.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.